the struggle between freedom and tyranny is not confined to any one nation or region. It is a global theme that, sadly, is becoming increasingly relevant in our time. Around the world, we are witnessing signs of a rising authoritarianism, along with a concerning suppression of human rights and civil liberties. Yet, we also see the courage of those who choose to resist it. The ongoing fight for democracy and dignity in Myanmar stands as a stark example of this global struggle, illuminating a shared human yearning for freedom, justice, and self-determination. In this way, their fight is everyone's fight. And so with that in mind, let's get into today's show. James Rodehaver, thank you so much for joining us on this episode of Inside Myanmar Podcast.
My pleasure.
We're going to be talking about your more recent position concerning Myanmar, but before we do so, I wonder if you can introduce your background, because I think the particular background that you have and the conflict zones you've been involved with shapes the discussion that we're going to have about Myanmar.
Sure, happy to. I've been working in human rights now for about the last 29 years. And I've worked in a variety of conflict zones and post-conflict zones in the world. I started in Sierra Leone and then moved on into the Balkans and Afghanistan, Syria, and now Myanmar. So I've spent most of my career with the United Nations. I've also worked for the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. I've taught law, and so that's been sort of the focus of my career, particularly looking at the protection of civilians and human rights violations that occur during an armed conflict.
So you've been in and around some difficult places before Myanmar, and you've brought your background of protecting human rights and dealing with some very bad actors, and how you're trying to bring these norms and laws to those situations. When you came to work on Myanmar, what did you see with Myanmar that might have been different or diverged from your previous backgrounds, and what was consistent?
Well, it's probably easier to say what was consistent is that, Myanmar, since I'd just been working on Syria, I was immediately struck by how similar the situation in Myanmar seemed to Syria, even before the crisis that engulfed Syria for over a decade during the Arab Spring. Just that a very fractured country, both ethnically and a government that very much dominated by an ethnicity and military apparatus that at times was extremely repressive and willing to invoke extreme hardship on its own people. What was different, though, in Myanmar is, of course, a level of complexity, a level of fractiousness that I think is very unique to Myanmar. It does seem that it's on a fault line of several historical and ethnic fault lines, or where the convergence of several civilizations and its history, its politics, the way in which its military operates was extremely unique. And since I came to this job actually before the coup in 2021, I was quite struck by how these different forces in the country seem to be pulled together or held together by this growing transition to democracy and the desire of people to continue this march towards a democratic reform and towards a growing human rights movement and growing civil society and civic space in the country. There were so many reasons for hope whenever I arrived. I was actually excited because I felt like finally I'm getting a break from armed conflict, and maybe I'll be able to work more on elements of post-conflict transition, transitional justice, issues of longer-term accountability.
It's so sad that that's not what happened and it turned into something extremely different.
Yes.
I realize we haven't yet talked about what your official post is and the department that you run and the work that you do. So if you can tell our audience what you're charged with doing in your particular position.
Sure. I run the team that is focused on Myanmar for the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, which is the specialized human rights office for the United Nations. Me and my team, we were set up specifically to do fact finding and to monitor the human rights situation in Myanmar. So specifically to look at issues of human rights violations that are ongoing, but also trying to look at the human rights violations that occurred over several years in the country, and to try to find ways to help civil society and governmental authorities to address those longer-term violations and to produce remedies, more of a cohesive response to human rights violations. But since the coup, we have been very much focused on the mandates that were given to our office by the Human Rights Council, which is to investigate human rights violations occurring since the coup, and to focus on how those take shape, what has happened in terms of the rule of law institutions in the country, what is happening in terms of civilians being targeted in the course of war, violations of international humanitarian law, and then to look also very specifically at the impact of the coup and the post-coup crisis on minority communities. So we do try to do all of those things as a sort of a core function of our office. The other part that we do is we also try to provide consistent human rights advice to the UN country team, so to the UN agencies working inside Myanmar, so that we can advise them on human rights, how they can do more to protect rights, to protect the people of Myanmar through their programming, in line with the UN's overall mandate in the world. And then I'd say the final part of our mandate is to, wherever possible, provide assistance to civil society to help them in their role of preserving human rights, educating Myanmar's people on human rights, and to seek for solutions that help protect the civilian population.
I noticed that one of the tasks that your office carries out is to brief other UN departments that are operating in the country on the protection of human rights. And I want to ask a sensitive question. I understand if you're not able to answer or have to answer carefully given your position, but I do want to acknowledge the sense of desperation bordering into real anger and disappointment on the behalf of the Burmese people towards the United Nations, and this feeling that they should be doing more there, that every time that we see one of those pictures with a UN representative formally meeting Min Aung Hlaing or some other top official, It generates a day of justifiable rage online and social media. And so I think that some listening could feel a sense of contradictory messages or hypocrisy that, well, what exactly are you doing with advising some of these other UN departments to be protecting human rights when we don't see any evidence of human rights actually being protected? Mm-hmm. So to whatever extent you're able to respond to this kind of concern or critique.
Well, I would just say that, you know, the of course, the anger of the people of Myanmar is completely, you know, it's completely understandable. I mean, they have been targeted now for, you know, 4 very long years, more than 4 years, by the institution of their, I apologize. I was going to say of their government, but since they are not a government, they are the institution in their country that is tasked specifically to protect them. Mm. That's the entire purpose behind their existence. And instead, they are targeting them. They are attacking them and trying to punish them for not supporting their coup d'etat. And so I understand that it's extremely, it's awful to not see, you know, a stronger response from the international community writ large, including from the United Nations, to their plight. And they have made enormous sacrifices. But in terms of the UN themselves, I mean, one has to understand that there are many UN agencies that they operate in a way to where they are, you know, they are dependent on access to areas in order to be able to deliver even modest assistance to the people of Myanmar. They also have to rely on security actors to give, you know, protection and guarantees of protection before they can move assistance or aid to the people that need it. And so that is the purpose behind meeting and engaging with authorities in the military is currently controlling. And it's wholly unsatisfactory because at the same time as they meet the military, you don't see those images then being publicized of meetings with the National Unity Government or with the CPHR the CRPH or or with any of the armed groups or the ethnic armed groups, and so it feels like a very unequal engagement, but yet those engagements do take place, and it's something that, frankly, from the angle of human rights, the United Nations has an obligation to engage wherever they are with any group that controls territory and who has essentially an obligation by virtue of their operations to protect civilians, to protect the lives of civilians, to protect humanitarians and their ability to serve the civilian population, the people who need aid most. So we, as a human rights office, do not object at all to that engagement. What we want to see is that when engagement occurs, that tough messages are passed, that there are tough messages about, look, you have an obligation to protect people. You aren't protecting them, you are targeting them. And there are things you could do to stop that, and if you're not willing to stop that, then frankly, you know, you are committing violations that will result one day in accountability. And those tough messages should be passed every time one of these meetings occurs. Mm. So, you know, it's very difficult for me to say that, well, you know, that the outrage is justifiable, they shouldn't be engaging with the military at all. I don't agree with that. Mm-hmm. I think the outrage is justified because the you don't see a, sort of an equality of engagement. But that is also because the military is targeting people that engage in any way with the armed groups and so forth. So it means there's a very unsatisfactory situation where, you know, engagement has to be kept. You know, some of engagement is made public or instrumentalized by the military, whereas the armed groups, the national unity government, and other actors, they actually respect the fact that we don't want to put humanitarians at risk, so we're not going to publicize our engagement with you. So it's a rather long answer, but it's an answer that I think has to be nuanced, because it's a nuanced situation. It's not that engagement isn't taking place equally across the board. It's just that some actors don't respect the fact that it's not supposed to be publicized.
Right. Yeah. I appreciate that. I appreciate that nuanced answer, and that's what we're here for. To follow up on a couple of points, I think that I appreciate how you said that they're bringing these tough messages every time they meet to talk about where certain rights are not being followed and adhered to, and demanding that they do so. I think, thinking of my listeners and those listeners in Burma, I think that a frustration with this is it's another. It feels like concerns and statements and hearts and prayers, that kind of thing.
Yes.
And I think even beyond that, sometimes we've seen different. And again, UN is very big. These are different departments, almost completely different organizations. So we don't want to lump everything in one monolithic part. And your particular remit and mission is singular with some of these others. But I think from an outside observer, there sometimes when there will be an atrocity that takes place, we'll see a carefully worded UN statement from some department where they won't actually even name the aggressor. You know, there was a bombing of a school and they deplored the violence without naming the aggressor who caused the violence, while kind of a both sidesism that shouldn't there, can we see an end to this violence without naming really who was the one perpetuating it. And I made the remark when that happened, this would be like if the UN existed in World War II, they would be expressing concern about the deplorable treatment of the Jews, but they didn't want to offend the Nazis, so they didn't say the Nazis were the aggressor. They just expressed concern that the Jews were being rounded up. I think that's one more particular specific concern. And the other is a concern, but also a question, because I might not, and one might not know the information not being publicized, or this might not be something that can be shared. But another aspect I wanted to get into was when the UN is administering programs and humanitarian aid, they're going through the central authorities. There's been a criticism that aid is then being pilfered by the military or used for people on their side or their supporters or the less needy, and it's not getting to those. I mean, this is a military that's bombing IDP camps, so how much can we trust military channels to go to IDP camps? And so while I understand that UN officials are meeting EAOs, PDFs, NUG, CRPH, etc., there's a question of, are UN humanitarian funds also going through some of those, we can call them non-conventional channels, because that's also been an issue of looking at this issue of sovereignty and authority and statehood, and what happens when, and looking at the background of Hugo Slim, I'm not sure how familiar you are with his work, but looking at with humanitarian resistance and looking at when you have a state actor who is not only not interested but highly neglectful of serving parts of their own population, then what are the avenues available for you for thinking non-conventionally and how that aid is distributed?
Well, let me just start by going back just for a second to the previous issue, which is just to say that, you know, one of the reasons, you know, the carefully worded statements are so unsatisfying is because they do nothing to identify the perpetrator. And oftentimes, you know, not to make excuses, but it's because statements oftentimes are happening right after an event has happened. The facts are not entirely clear in some cases. Now, if it's an airstrike, there's only one side that has planes. So it's very clear at that. But there are other times whenever
you know, all the facts of how a situation unfolded are not clear. Like whether a school building has been occupied by another armed force or not. Because instances like that have happened. Rarer from what we can verify, but still, so there's that inherent caution of not speaking before you know the facts. Now, in the cases where it is clear, you know, I agree that a perpetrator should always be named if you have the facts to support it. And that includes simple common sense. But that's also where my office comes in, because we don't pull punches. And we do have a mandate to name perpetrators. We have a mandate to report publicly. And so we do. It's why we've put out 14 public reports since this crisis began. And we try, anytime we meet our legal standard of proof, we name the perpetrator. And if we even have, you know, credible reports that make it clear who the perpetrator was, in all likelihood, we will still say it. Because we think that that element of accountability is critical. Because then, at least, the member states that support one side or the other cannot say they didn't know. So that's another element of accountability that we want to ensure is there. Now, in terms of the overall sort of humanitarian responsibility and where aid is going, I mean, this is where, you know, it's so damning that a key aspect of the four-cut strategy has always been to limit humanitarian access and the ability of aid to get to those who need it most. And it has been crippling. And it's been a very tough riddle to solve. I mean, it's bad enough that in Myanmar, the crisis has touched all facets of society. You know, you have this coup that was perpetrated through a series of massive, systematic human rights violations, using force. And then it prompts a humanitarian aspect of the crisis, which has gotten worse and worse to the point where it's at emergency level criticality. And then you have an economic collapse that has also created massive humanitarian need. And then, of course, the political crisis, which is also one of those elements that I think that no one has ever satisfactorily found a way to untie this political Gordian knot that has been tied by virtue of the inability to recognize a legitimate government or a government, you know, representation. And then what that does is it ties a diplomatic community and an international community in knots as to how they function and operate responsibly. And I have a great deal of respect and sympathy for Hugo Slim and his work and that activist humanitarian side. It's something I sympathize with deeply because it's one of the things that I think it is the responsibility of human rights to point out all of those areas where, you know, a humanitarian response has to take into account human rights aspects as well, one of which being accountability. And I see that humanitarianism has that responsibility if they're really going to take protection seriously. But how you then make sure that the aid is getting to those people that need it most is a difficult question whenever one of the parties to the conflict is specifically saying, we'll let you have access to deliver humanitarian aid, but not in any of the areas affected by conflict. It's a twisted logic. And unfortunately, the humanitarian need has grown so much to where there are more than enough areas to deliver humanitarian assistance to that are not conflict affected. Because the nature of this crisis has grown so large. So in the end, it creates this dilemma of, okay, you can't even get to the areas that need aid most. And whenever you do get access to those areas, it's either done informally or it's done in ways where perhaps the most badly needed assistance can't get there because you know it'll be confiscated. Mm. So instead, you deliver assistance to other areas, which are also extremely critical, but they're not the conflict-affected areas. So it creates this perception that aid is going to areas that where it's essentially being instrumentalized. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But that is not the case as I understand it, at least not in the vast majority of cases. It's just, unfortunately, it's just at this point, whenever you have like over a third of the country being in humanitarian need, you know, three quarters of the country that are just at or below the poverty level, the level of needs here are creating far beyond the capacity of a humanitarian response whenever it's being limited so dramatically by one of the parties.
I suppose a question does come, though, and I think this touches upon the thorny issues of sovereignty and statehood and international order of things. But if you have a central, and again, it's not a government, I guess we could say central, we could say authority, the those that are in some degree of authority, that they're actually in authority and controlling very little of the territory. That's the kind of the strange thing here.
Probably 30% or less of the territory.
30% or less of the territory. So by your own estimation of that, if 70% or more of the territory is being controlled, is outside of the control of what is recognized as a sovereign authority, then just to put it bluntly, why would the UN be asking permission of a so-called authority that retains, that has violated everything, that doesn't have a mandate, and that has doesn't even have the authority to tell them or to bring them to these places? Why not go to those places, to those individuals or organizations that are administering that authority where there are displaced people's camps of thousands of people, and go through them to be able to deliver the aid effectively in those regions?
Well, first of all, those requests are made, and they're made repeatedly. The question is, how do you get the aid there? And it's more of a simple, practical question. How can you, if you're limited in what you're allowed to import, and you have on one side a military force that's essentially saying, you cannot go. If you try to take trucks across what we call the front lines, we will stop them. Mm-hmm. We will confiscate them. We are not giving you permission to go to those places controlled by terrorists, you know. And on the other side, the only way you can get to those areas is to go across international borders. Mm-hmm. Then you have to have the implicit help of the neighboring countries to do it. Mm-hmm. And, or you have to rely on informal means of getting items to those who need it in any way you can. And unfortunately, it's that last wholly inadequate option, which seems to be the only way right now, at least, the aid is getting across. And because, at least right now, the neighbors of Myanmar are being very reluctant, as I understand it. Again, this is not my field or my mandate, but as I understand it, the aid that does get through is gets through very informally. It's not part of a what would you say, scaled up systematic response to a humanitarian crisis.
I appreciate that response, and I also appreciate this is not your direct mandate, and I think it was valuable to be able to go there and get your understanding of of these issues. And I do want to segue into your particular mandate, and you have your office has just issued a couple of reports looking at the worsening situation, especially in 2024. I mean, you shared it with us before the interview, and the findings are absolutely just devastating, just heartbreaking in terms of how much worse things are still getting or and are continuing to get. So I invite you to share with us the main points of what your findings came to in these reports.
Sure. I mean, to put it very simply, it what we've tried to do is to paint a picture, because 2024 was essentially the deadliest year for civilians since this crisis began. Mm-hmm. You had across-the-board increases in the number of civilians that were verified as being killed, and the vast majority of those, over 62% of those killed, were killed by indiscriminate use of heavy weaponry. So airstrikes, artillery, mortar attacks, drone attacks, perpetrated by the Myanmar military against its own people. You had over almost 2,000 people that were verified as being killed in 2024. Now, one of the things that this report tries to do that, but perhaps doesn't go into great detail on, is to also point out how inadequate that data is. Because, as I just mentioned, that is, you know, over 1,800 or nearly 2,000 verified deaths. And over, you know, 6,300 verified deaths at this point of people that are known to have been killed by the military. Now, that is, the verification process is a very, you know, it's a very lengthy, time-sensitive process that in some cases takes months and months and months to verify a single individual death. And we know that there are huge territories throughout Myanmar that are essentially information black holes because the military has cut off systematically communications with those areas, like in Sagaing, Magway, Rakhine State, the southeast of the country, where airstrikes occur constantly. Mm-hmm. And yet very little information about the numbers of civilians killed are being verified. So with that in mind, we know that the number is far higher than 1,800 just from the military. And then on the other side of it, we also know that ethnic armed organizations, the PDF movement, that their attacks, you know, very naturally result in civilian casualties as well. And we also know that in some cases, they have a very different understanding of IHL than I was taught in law school. And so they do target civilian officials, the family members of civilian officials and military officials that they accuse of aiding the military-run authority in Naypyidaw. So we know that there are a large number of civilians that are being impacted by those casualties, even though we can't verify that, so we can't report it. So we know that there is a massive impact of this crisis on the civilian population just from the standpoint of the numbers of people killed. Now, on the other side of it, we also know that the military routinely rounds people up and kills them rather than putting them in detention long term, or they end up being killed during interrogations through the use of torture or other heavy-handed interrogation methods. So that's another 21% of the total casualties from last year. Then we also know that they are forcibly conscripting people that they round up, and they're forcing them into military service, where they get very little training and then are forced into the fighting on the front lines. So even though those people are no longer classified as civilians, we know that that is resulting in a large number of deaths and forcible conscriptions. Then, of course, there is, as I already alluded to, the overall impact on the economy, on the humanitarian situation, where the impacts are massive. You have runaway inflation. You have the devaluation of the currency. You have the massive number of young people and skilled workers who have chosen to flee the country to avoid being conscripted, or who can no longer work because of the crackdown on unions and on workers throughout the country, or who have lost contracts because international investment is simply no longer occurring in the vast majority of the country. So the sheer impact on, I guess you'd call it the opportunity economy of the country, whether people actually see a future, whether they see a life for themselves, you know, then you have the impact on livelihoods. As I say, you know, three quarters, over 75% of the population estimated to be just at or below the poverty line. The malnutrition that's resulted, that over 15 million people are facing hunger this year. It's a massive impact. And over, you're close to 20 million people just in core humanitarian need. And that's probably an underestimation. So we've tried to paint the picture of just really a country in free fall as a result of massive systematic human rights violations.
That's devastating. I mean, you've just labeled so many threads. You've identified so many threads, and each one of those we can go into for an hour-long conversation. And these are all happening simultaneously and falling apart together, and also geographically across the region, north to south, east to west, Bamar and ethnic. It's really looking systematically at every aspect of this in just a critical, dire, worsening state. It's hard to know even where to go and how to respond to just such horror and destruction. I mean, even like the terminology, I'm trying to think of what are the synonyms I can use for devastating, because I've already said that five times. What words do I use to even describe it? So rather than following up and pulling those threads, as fascinating and important as it would be, I want to use that as a jumping off point of understanding 2024 as being a much worse year, 2025 maybe sadly worse than that, looking at that reality as if things couldn't get worse within the country. We now have the shutoff of USAID and the Western response to international response to similarly starting to decrease their own aid as well. And so what impact are you seeing in this lessening and in some cases absolute shutting off of international aid to media, to the democracy movement, to health, et cetera?
Well, and again, this is an area that where it's beyond the scope of my mandate, but just anecdotally, you know, we see the impact that it's having on humanitarians and on civil society programming. Just the absence of core assistance that was needed to keep organizations running mm-hmm. and functional. And I think that the full extent of the impact of that is still unclear. But just whenever you start hearing that in a country that is beset with all of the problems that I just laid out, where civilians are being, of course, killed, but what we can't really put a number to are the number of civilians wounded, injured, traumatized. Mm. You know, an area that I didn't even get to earlier was mentioning, you know, the complete collapse or lack of functionality in civil service. So just on a basic level of service delivery, you know, there are not many functional hospitals or clinics that people trust enough to go to whenever they are injured or whenever they get sick. You've had outbreaks of cholera and other diseases that one thought probably were, you know, ailments of the past. You know, polio, typhus. It's really quite striking the number of horrors that have beset the civilian population. And then you think that because of these cuts in aid or refocusing of aid to military spending and to the crises in Ukraine and Gaza and other areas of the world, the impact that has are that hospitals have to shut down. Functional, civil society-run hospitals, medical clinics, service provision, food distribution, immunization efforts have just ground to a halt. And that core capacity in society that has been of keeping talented professionals and service providers in Myanmar in the country, helping their fellow citizens. That's what that aid has been able to do, is to keep a critical mass of the most talented people in Myanmar in Myanmar. And now that funding's gone or is significantly diminished. And very soon you're going to have people having to ask really horrific questions. Like, where should aid be targeted? Is it, okay, is it going to be to keep education initiatives going? Or do we have enough to do both life-saving assistance and education initiatives for young people? Do we have the ability to keep like entrepreneurial assistance or local assistance to basic services going? To keep democratic governance growing, conflict resolution initiatives, so that at the local level, whenever people commit crimes, that, you know, some sort of, you know, justice system can work. Do we keep initiatives like that going, or is it only, do we only have the space now to fund life-saving assistance? And what is life-saving? Do you have to further prioritize to say that, well, it's only assistance that keeps people alive today that we can continue funding? So you're going to find that a lot of critical services are no longer able to be funded based on how policymakers make those critical choices. They're really, you know, it's like an age-old conundrum. The parable of how do you split a baby in half? You know, it's going to be tough choices of that graphic a nature that are going to have to be made as a result of these cuts. And then for the area that is within, you know, my you know, purview or mandate, it's looking at the impact on civic space more generally. Civic space has been demolished. It's been smashed by the military deliberately. Trying to make it as difficult as possible for non-governmental organizations to function. And civic space, though it's been strangled, it is not suffocated entirely. It is not died. It has been kept alive in areas outside the military control, and even very brave people still operating in areas that the military does control. But that has a cost to it. They've been able to operate because of money and funding, and because they've been able to keep talented people willing to work and to take risks. And yet now we're going to find that maybe that can't continue. So civic space is going to shrink further as a result of this. Good organizations where people are going out and giving essential assistance to newly released prisoners, or to victims that survived, you know, village raids or aerial attacks. Those people are going to have to shut down now, and Myanmar will be much poorer for it. So I think that however you look at it, these funding cuts are going to result in the crisis worsening in ways that we haven't put a metric to yet. And the capacity of well-meaning people to continue to help the people of Myanmar who have already sacrificed so much in order to resist this military coup is going to be greatly diminished. And that, to me, the only adjective that comes to mind when I think of that is tragic. It is a tragedy that the international community bears in the end a responsibility for that aspect of the tragedy. And it's unconscionable, not to say because we don't understand the realities that aid sometimes has to be prioritized to one part of the world or not. But in the end, to me, the real tragedy here is that there is a window of opportunity in Myanmar to make a massive difference with political pressure and with economic financial funding. It's an opportunity that is available because of the sacrifices of the people and because of the successes of the ethnic armed groups in fighting the military that is going to be lost because aid was sent elsewhere where those opportunities do not exist. So pumping money into areas where opportunities are fewer or further between versus Myanmar, where a real difference and real progress could have been made as a result of that funding.
I don't know what to say to that. That's so powerful and as you say, so tragic as well. And it leaves me with just one question there, and that's that someone such as yourself and the position and the authority that you have, the organizational backing and the mandate that you've been given to be able to make a statement of this nature with the reliability, the evidence, the documentation behind that statement. You know what you're talking about, in other words, and you have the background of your team to and your reports to be able to build into the truth of what you said. And so as you believe this and you've proclaimed it, I'm sure that you've had any number of conversations, official, unofficial, informal, behind closed doors, public, etc., with any number of members of the international community, of international organizations, of heads, people, of stakeholders, of people who seemingly have the ability to engage in one way or another. And when you're making this impassioned argument to them, when you're saying this is a place where, and this is what we've said on our podcast in so many ways, but you know, at the level that you're talking about, when you're able to say, we have the ability to make a difference. Yes, it's going to be hard, but look at the people in the country and what they want and what it means to support them, the minimal support that we need compared to these other places, the fraction of focus that it would take to be able to proceed in this way, that if we're able to just keep the light on just a little bit more, and they're carrying it, but they need that outside support. They're asking for very little. If we just provide that very little, this is what they're able to do, and this is the potential win that we're able to have as an international community at a time when so much else is going wrong. So as you have made those impassioned arguments to people who seemingly one would think would, or organizations that could be inclined to hear this and to respond in a certain way, I'm curious what measure of responses you've heard from these kinds of discussions or dialogues.
I really don't know how to answer that question other than to say, I hear a lot of, I'm very sorry, but policy has been made elsewhere. You know, priorities have been refocused elsewhere. And that's about the only response that I get, that there's a lot of empathizing, a lot of sympathizing, even some agreement with how we see the situation. But in the end, it seems that the decisions were made and have been motivated by other factors.
It's very passive. Yeah, it seems like that in all sides of the conversation, there's a lack of agency everywhere.
Yes.
Or
I think that much is rather clear. I think there are, maybe not passive, but just there are much more aggressive arguments being made elsewhere,
or
much more aggressive considerations weighing upon these decisions that maybe would make sense if the full picture was laid out to us. But I have not yet seen that full picture laid out.
Right. Or to say it another way, it sounds like the individuals that you're talking to with that response that indicates the lack of agency, that
the impassioned argument that you're trying to make and that you are making seems to not be directly reaching those people who can say the buck stops with me, and that cannot give a passive response of decisions have already been made, and that can say, well, we have, or I have made another decision based on this. I hear your argument, I'm not moved by it. It sounds like those are the level of discussions you're not having.
Well, that's true. And I also think that it is emblematic, or maybe not emblematic. It's the impact, it's the direct result of the limited nature of international engagement on Myanmar.
Sure.
It's the limited access and interest, frankly, of media on Myanmar. And I think to a certain degree, it's also a failure of the organizations in Myanmar to tell a comprehensive story about the full scope and scale of this crisis. Mm-hmm. I think the people that really know Myanmar well get how serious the situation is. But I think that if you look to a wider constituency of taxpayers, that you want to care enough about Myanmar to demand that their governments give it more attention, more money, more priority. We have not told a compelling enough story. And part of that is not just the full weight of the lack of access in the country, of the problems of having communications restricted so heavy-handedly, but also just this, you know, how do we make a more compelling case whenever we do get that media access? How do we make a better case with the information we do have at our disposal? And so I take partial responsibility for that myself. So.
That's really interesting. And how would you answer your own question? How would you look at where this more compelling story could be told and told in different ways and in different places that's not being done now?
Well, I think that part of it is that whenever you have a limited amount of aid and assistance that's available, there's always going to be competition amongst actors, organizations, agencies working in a limited space. And they will see the information at their disposal as one of their most precious commodities. And if that information is not freely shared or not collaboratively analyzed, then it's hard to address that problem that I mentioned before. It's hard, but I do think that the information, that there needs to be a more strategic look at the information that is available, and a stronger push to collaborate across international agencies working on Myanmar, and across both a greater outreach between international organizations and civil society to make better use of the information that we have at our disposal. To see, have we fully told the story of what the civilian community, what the people of Myanmar have sacrificed, mm-hmm. what their daily lives, what the pressures they're under, how those take shape, how they impact an individual's life? And then lastly, I think we also need to put pressure on media to go into Myanmar, because 70% of the country is accessible. And, you know, risks, of course, need to be taken to do that. But journalists take risks all the time. Mm. And it's one of the reasons why they are such a precious and valuable commodity when it comes to accountability, when it comes to holding individuals accountable, when it comes to holding states accountable for the choices they make in terms of where they put their pressure. And the aid that they distribute.
You spoke before about the varying shades of understanding of IHL, international humanitarian law, among the actors in Myanmar. And so I wonder to what degree your mandate has been to bring an understanding of IHL to the various actors, to the PDFs, the EROs. I even wonder if you've had any communication and what the nature has been that you're able to share with the SAC. But to what degree have you, has your team been involved, and is your mandate and your mission being to help those groups on the ground of any authority understand what this means and how to enact it?
Well, I human rights education and elements of protection of, measures that can be taken to protect civilians, which is based in an understanding of IHL. Mm. That sort of educational component is part of our mandate. And so we do work through civil society groups. We, in some cases, we offer our services as trainers or as educators with armed groups, with armed actors on the ground. We also, of course, try to communicate whenever we write our reports and we're doing our investigations and research to prepare public reports. We also routinely reach out to armed parties to ask them questions about different incidents that we're investigating, or to ask them what measures they are taking to protect civilians or to avoid civilian casualties or impacts on civilian life through their combat operations. And so we do that form of engagement. But we do, of course, offer straight up, trainings and education where we can. And we have been able to do some of that. But, I would need a much larger team to have a reach. And I would also need to have access inside the country to have a broader impact. Now, I know that there are other organizations out there that do give that training. So we also make sure that we coordinate, both to ensure that we know, who is doing educational initiatives, and because they're happening in several parts of the country, and also what they're using in terms of training materials to make sure, are there gaps in just the basic educational materials. But we also look for other partners that do have access that can take those messages as well. So we train, groups that, humanitarians, civil society organizations that have access in local communities, who can give trainings also to local leaders, on the civilian side, because, local communities should know what are the obligations of the armed groups that operate in their areas, because then they can demand a more responsible response and activity from armed actors in their area. They know what they can demand and how they should be behaving. And that's a critical component of protection as well, and of understanding IHL. And then, most importantly, I think it's also informing what practical measures they can take to better protect people. Do people in local villages know which armed actors are in their areas? You assume they do, but, do they? And do they understand their responsibilities? Do they understand that whenever armed actors head into their village, do they plan escape routes or evacuation routes? So if an exchange of fire erupts, where can they run to safety? Do they know how to build, for example, to dig effective trenches or obstacles to help them take shelter in the case of an air raid, for example. Some practical measures that they can take in order to put, at least minimize some of the risks they face. So, and those are components that can be worked into humanitarian responses, can be worked into aid distribution packages, or even like basic education initiatives. Making sure children or disabled people also know what they can do to protect themselves. how to spot landmines or unexploded ordnance, things like that, that all factor into the rather complex environment that normal people find themselves in Myanmar. Mm-hmm. So we try to do that as much as possible through our engagement with civil society and through parties to the armed conflict. We have a variety of ways that we do engage. You know, if we can meet in person, we do. If we can have video calls, we do. It just depends on how receptive different groups are. In some cases, certain groups, including, you know, the military, we send written communications. We try to engage with all actors. I said earlier that, you know, engagement should be with everyone that has an obligation. Mm-hmm. So we try to observe that, but we don't always get meetings. Mm-hmm. So it limits how we can engage or how frequently we can engage. But we constantly try to pass those messages of protection mm-hmm. and accountability, mm-hmm. understanding obligations and how they should respond to minimize the violations that they may or may not be committing.
And to whatever degree you're able to share publicly, have you been, in addition to those written communications over the years, have you been able to have any direct engagement of any kind with the military? I ask that because I'm just personally curious if you had a representative you were able to talk to and point out these egregious human rights violations and to have any kind of dialogue. I'm just curious what their response would possibly be in that kind of engagement, if they would so much as pick up the phone or answer at all.
Our engagement with them has been quite limited.
Yeah.
We have tried to pass messages through other people that do get to meet directly with the military, but even then, the military rarely gives access to actual decision makers or anyone on the military side of their operations. It's usually, you know, functionaries in their, you know, bureaucratic system that they force you people to talk to. And those engagements, I've been told before that whenever the issue of human rights comes up, it's the quickest way to end a meeting.
Oh.
Because they either lose any interest in engaging further at that point, or it becomes a recitation of a party line, rather than actually having a conversation that could bolster protection.
That's disturbing with everything else, but not surprising. I'm conscious of the time, and I thank you so much for sharing this valuable information. We could have pulled on any of these threads and gone on and on in those directions. It's been so insightful, and I thank you for taking time with us and also for the work that you've done. I want to end on a personal note because you, as you mentioned, you came into this role thinking that you might be actually moving away from some of the past conflict that you'd been involved with before in other parts of the world and looking at transitional justice and being able to move beyond what had been a difficult history in Myanmar and look towards strengthening democratic institutions and civil society. Obviously, something very different has happened. And for you in this position, there certainly is a thing of second degree trauma. That's something that I know one is always shy to talk about because it feels uncomfortable to talk about one's own response when there's others in such danger, but it's also a real thing.
No, it is. At times it's quite heavy. I have to say that probably the worst aspect of all of this for me is the fact that my team and I are not in the country. Mm-hmm. That we're not able to go in and be on the ground to share the risks mm-hmm. of this situation with the victims, that we're not there, like, able to make eye contact to share they're paying to form that very human bond of empathy, which I think is not only, you know, there is a crisis of human rights in this world right now. The norms that were put in place to avoid the Second World War ever happening again are being eroded systematically, and they have been for quite a while now. But I think that what is equally under siege and under assault right now is empathy. There just seems to be so many factors in the world right now seem to be trying to drain people of empathic responses or to ridicule empathic responses. Mm-hmm. And yet I think that it's the duty of human rights workers in particular to never lose that empathic connection with the people that we are there to serve. And, you know, it's like I'm often told that the UN has an obligation to observe the principles of, you know, independence, impartiality, neutrality, you know, et cetera. And yet, to me, we do have that duty to be independent, to be impartial, but we don't have an obligation to be neutral, because we do pick a side in this fight. We pick the side of the victims, and we are there to help the victims. Whoever has violated their rights, we are supposed to be helping. And so, you know, it takes a toll not being able to be there to, like I say, to make that sort of personal connection with people. But it's something that I've learned to deal with over the years by ensuring, first of all, that I'm much more empathic an understanding of the strains that my team goes through to try and support them in their work, so that they have the capacity, the wherewithal, the stamina to keep up what is an extremely hard task, mm-hmm. of doing investigations remotely whenever you're not inside, going to the site and the scene of crimes and violations. Making sure that I'm also holding them accountable to where, you know, they are following up with victims, that they are also trying to help the victims find ways to refer them to services to help them after they've interviewed them about the depredations they've suffered. So it's really about trying to be as human as I can as a manager and as a leader within my team. And then the other side of it as well is to make sure that I'm as outspoken as I can be, that I push the boundaries of what I can say, when I can say it, how often I say it, to make sure that the message is getting out about the nature of this crisis, how serious it is, how the victims are being impacted, and how many people are victims. And that information gets to policymakers, gets to the media, and, you know, maybe because the crisis keeps getting worse and because the pressure is not getting more intense, maybe that means I've failed. But I try not to take that personally. Just keep trying. Keep trying, find new ways to do better. So that's what I try to do on a professional level. On a personal level, I tried to hug my kids tighter. I try to be a better person. I try to be a more understanding husband, a more responsible dog owner. I try to look for ways to handle the stress. You know, I do, I paint, I look for beauty in the world. Mm. And you know, I exercise, I try to be healthy. And that's not always easy. So it's about, in the end, and this is a key part, I think, of empathy and of health, it's looking for whatever positive aspect of this crisis you can find. And to me, the only positive aspect of the crisis, it is the triumphal spirit of the Myanmar people, who have been ill-served for so long by a military that has repeatedly shown that they have no interest in doing right by their own people, by their own citizens. And that these people have withstood countless abuses and sacrifices and have endured. And they deserve so much better. And yet they still find ways to be charmingly human, resilient, tough, tenacious. Their spirit is inspiring. And I try to take that into account every day and really try to remember who I'm working for and why I'm working for them. And that, to me, is the best way to cope with the nature of this crisis.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Insight Myanmar Podcast. As with many of our conversations, the one you just heard shines a light on a pressing issue regarding the challenges and complexities now being faced by Myanmar and its people. These stories are powerful and necessary to raise our awareness. But the real value of having our awareness raised comes from when it can be translated into some type of positive action. And this is where our pitch comes in. One such action could be supporting us in producing more episodes like this one, so that we can continue to air diverse stories and perspectives about what's happening in Myanmar. That will help raise the awareness and reaching even more listeners who themselves might be propelled to take some type of action. As you might imagine, we do have production costs, and it's mainly the generous support of our listeners that enable us to continue this important work in amplifying voices that need to be heard. And so by contributing, you're not just supporting a podcast, you're helping to create a space for solutions to emerge, for stories to inspire change, and for awareness to develop into meaningful action. If you believe in the importance of these conversations and want to help us keep them going, visit insightmyanmar.org/donation. Together, we can make sure these critical conversations continue to inspire action and change.
Yarananda, 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 Yarananda,